Luther Ingram passed away on this day in 2007. Of course, wrote that great song, Respect Yourself, the Staple Singers made so famous. He was a great singer and songwriter who we lost in 2007. Romani, you want to wage this important conversation. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord and Josh Fattel were three young Americans arrested along the border between Iraq and Iran in 2009, kind of enticed into Iran and then accused of being spies by Iranian authorities. So no evidence was ever given, obviously, at all. Sarah was released after 14 months after being arrested. Shane Bauer, who was a guest on the show last July, and Josh Fattel were released in September 2011. They've put together a book now, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. All three of these people were have been before, now, and after, fighters for human rights, social justice, and a new world, have written a very enlightened, interesting book and are continuing to fight against, in this country, solitary confinement. And Shane, Sarah, Josh, welcome. Good to have you here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thanks, Mark. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Good to have you all here. And you all will be coming to Baltimore. We should let folks know that three of them will be here this Saturday night at Red Emmis at 7:30 at 30 West North Avenue. More information at redemmis.org, also on our website. But they'll all be here to talk with you, and so you should get there early. Place will fill up, 410-319. I mean, you can also call now at 410-319-8888 to join in our conversation. Join us at steinershow@gmail.com or tweet us at Mark Steiner. So, again, good to have you here. And it's a fascinating book. I mean, you two, I know, Shane, that you are the journalist, but all three of you have written incredible pieces in this book. Very powerful stuff. I think, you know, there are many people who very quickly do not know the story from the beginning. And this is, and if one of you just pick up just what happened, if you were in Damascus, why you were there, and then came to Kurdistan, the most peaceful zone of Iraq, and took a hike. Give us a quick synopsis, maybe, Sarah, if you would, of what happened that day.
Yeah, of course. So Shane and I had been living in Syria for over a year, and Shane had been in the region for years before that. I was teaching Iraqi refugees and doing some journalism, and he was a journalist in the region. And when Josh came to visit us, we talked about where we should go, and we decided on northern Iraq, Iraqi Kurdistan, because it was really a different Iraq, Iraq that few Americans even know exists. It is it's almost its own country within Iraq. And in 2011, it was on the top travel destinations recommended by the New York Times. It's green. It has its own culture. We toured and visited castles and museums. And then we asked around. We said, we've been seeing these posters everywhere of these beautiful mountains and waterfalls. Where can we go? And several people told us to go to the same place, Ahmed Awa. And when we arrived, there were hundreds of people enjoying themselves by the waterfall and camping overnight, and they pointed out a trail for us. If any mistake we made, we hiked too far. We were a bit overzealous. We were really enjoying each other's company.
And that piece that you wrote in the beginning of the book about being beckoned by this Iranian guard, and then you discovered you're in Iran, and then were arrested. And it is. The way you tell this story is very profound, and I think that, let me just jump right to a piece here which I think is important for us to kind of put our hands around. And Sarah, I mean, you were in solitary confinement, if I have this right, for 410 days?
Yeah, that's
right,
correct.
Right? And you, all three of you were in solitary confinement for a period of that time. And I don't think people understand, we've done shows about this before, about what happens to someone in solitary confinement, the kind of damage that can happen. As you, I think, wrote, Sarah, that some people with the studies have said after 15 days, that kind of, it can cause permanent damage, lasting
damage.
That's
what the UN says.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, the UN says 15 days can constitute torture. I was held for 410 days, and you know, many people in our own country are held for years or decades in very similar conditions. This doesn't only happen in Iran. You're really kind of reduced to an animal-like state. I spent a lot of time pacing my cell compulsively, crouched down by a small slot in my cell door, just listening for sounds to orient myself. And your world shrinks. It just gets smaller and smaller. It feels like a slow death. You lose contact with everything on the outside.
And Josh Fortell, I've not yet talked to you. It's great to have you on the air as well with us. Looking at the story you tell, whether you're with in the same cell with Shane or by yourself, what's amazing to me is parts of these stories where what you have to do to keep yourself occupied, but also the kind of courage that comes up for whatever reason and wells up to stand up to the people that are holding you hostage, that are your oppressors. That is a pretty amazing piece to see how you sometimes would just have to stand up and go, hit me, do what you want. Don't hit me like that again. I mean, that's something we don't think will happen.
This is Shane here. That time actually that was happening with me where Josh was getting pulled away.
Right.
There was kind of a misunderstanding. He got thrown down the stairs and I was suddenly terrified about what was happening to him. I didn't know. You know, other prisoners told me, you know, that they had been beaten, had the hair pulled out, all kinds of terrible things. And so I was imagining the worst and I was trying to fight to go after him. And this guard came back and with his billy club and threw me in the cell and it just seemed like he was going to beat the crap out of me. And I wanted to keep him off Josh at that moment. I was just thinking, what can I do? This guy's huge. You know, there's no way I can fight this guy. And I knew in that moment that the worst thing that would happen to him is if he beat me, because I knew that we were important to the Iranian government. We were valuable to them. So I just told him, you know, to hit me. And, you know, he threw me against a wall and it was terrifying. Another guard pulled him off. But there were many examples of this. So we all went through this and we came to find that it was kind of an important way to stay sane, really, was to kind of maintain our dignity and to be standing up against these people who were holding us. You know, sometimes it would be that we heard other people being beaten and we would just cause a commotion, bang on the doors. Sometimes we went on hunger strikes ourselves. And sometimes it was just, you know, they tell you to hurry up and go and you don't. I mean, there's just many, many nuanced ways that we would kind of maintain our own identity and our own dignity in that situation.
And there was various influences that had us move in that direction. One of them was the Iranian prisoners next to us. There was one Iranian prisoner, I remember, just who was a neighbor, and he would never wear his blindfold on. He would put it all the way up to his forehead, and the guard, it would anger the guards so much. But he would refuse to do it, and he would yell, and they'd get into yelling, and then the guards would hit him for it. But the sort of defiance that was all around us spread to us. In other words, friends would send us books, and one of the books that a friend sent us from the U.S. was the slave narrative of Frederick Douglass, and him standing up to the slave master was an inspiration to me and to us to sort of take that spirit and move on. And so we were playing off of other people, other Iranian prisoners, people in the past, and then really each other, watching each other kind of take a different attitude, a different role, stance towards the guards helped this sort of emboldening process that really became almost a collective spirit, definitely a collective spirit, actually.
One of the things that I thought about in the story of your three stories, and I think many people who are involved in struggles for human rights, for dignity, for a better world, for social justice, that the three of you have been involved in all your lives and continue to be involved in, that to be held as something else, to be used in a way as a pawn, but also to be held as something you would never be, an Israeli spy, an American spy, whatever that would be. I mean, that I just thought about that frustration and that kind of the kind of contradictory madness of that particular situation. You know, because of who you are, who the three of you, what you represent, what you believe in. I saw this morning a picture that one of my producers showed me, Josh, of you after you got back with your camera facing down the American police in a demonstration out west. I mean, you know, that's who you are, but here you are being locked up for being something else.
Well,
go ahead. You all can start. Josh, Sarah, go ahead.
Let me just... You know, if you ever, like, going through life and you don't feel heard by somebody, you know, that's sort of the feeling times 10, you know, to be in prison and be sort of saying, you know, you think you're arresting someone that's representing the U.S. government, but that's not me. That, you know, this is not me.
And, right.
the level of frustration there was just madness. They would sort of interrogate my my politics in Israel and in Palestine and would try to sort of pick out something that would be anything that could hint at espionage. And for them, anything I visited Israel several times because half my family is over there. My father's Israeli. He lives in the States, but his side of the family is over there. And so they wanted to know the details of every trip over there and this sort of stuff. But they weren't actually seeing me. And this is, walking in the streets, protesting against the wars and this sort of long, not long, but young history of activism and trying to separate out the people from the government. And this is something that, the Iranians claim to do in their media. And, America claims to do it with the Iranians. They always say the government is separate from the people. But both governments seem to only do that when it fits their purposes. And
right.
In this case, it didn't fit the Iranian government's purpose to separate us from our government.
Sarah?
Well, it really, as brutal and dehumanizing as it was to have nothing that we ever did in our lives make any difference to the Iranian government, to ultimately to the judge and interrogators. We were just Americans. But when it came to the movement to free us, the international campaign that eventually succeeded where diplomacy failed, it did make a difference. There's someone that Shane and I knew, a close friend in Damascus, that wrote a song for us. And she sings in the song that we were protected, that our light was protected by every other person that we'd shined on. Mm. And it really makes you realize that that every relationship that you had in your life matters and that everything that you do matters. In our case, these people, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, played a role in the campaign that eventually was successful in giving us our lives back.
Actually, let me just say, though, that although in a sense it didn't it didn't matter. There was one day we met with the Omani envoy, who was the go-between between the U.S. and Iran in our release, in our in negotiations. And we met with him, and we told him who we were and what we stood for. And then he had the president's ear that night. And so we have no idea what kind of effect that had.
Which president? President of the United States or president of Iran?
The president of Iran's ear.
Okay, right. I want to be clear. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. The president of Iran. I mean, we were in Iran. He visited us in Iran, and that night he went to meet the president of Iran. And so one of the first sections of the Iranian government, which is very complex and divided, one of the first was the president to come out and want our release before the judiciary, which was ultimately the ones that held us the longest.
Something I think about is in prison, Guantanamo Bay came up a number of times, and
right.
There were times that I was in solitary and I asked a guard, why am I, it's been months, why am I still in solitary confinement? And he said, well, what about Guantanamo Bay? How long are people held in solitary in Guantanamo Bay? And then a year and a half later, saying, why haven't gone to trial yet? If you think we're guilty, just take us to trial. And they said, well, how long do people sit in Guantanamo Bay without trial or in the CIA black sites? And, so after getting out, it is something, after being held for so long without trial, being held in solitary confinement, it makes it really clear that it's really hard to argue. And, the State Department was saying, take them to trial. It's hard to make that argument legitimately when we're doing that at the same time. We're holding people without trial for sometimes 10 years. We hold 80,000 people in solitary confinement, many of them for decades. After going through that experience, it's just like, that wasn't right to happen to us. It's not right for it to happen anywhere. It doesn't matter what country it's in. We're not an exception here.
Oh, two things strike
Mark,
me. This is Shane. Go ahead. Yeah.
This is Josh.
Josh. Yeah.
I want to say, I became a student of Iranian state television when I was over there, because that was one of the things in the cell. So I became this religious observer of Iranian state television. Almost. It was like every night there was a little bit in English news, and I'd watch it religiously and try to like discern some message from it, figure out what was going on. And they at one point had reporters in Washington, D.C., and they'd report on income inequality in America. They'd report on race discrimination in America and all these sort of causes that I would be sympathetic to and embrace and would be reading the news about if I were free. So it was interesting to get tidbits and news, but it was also interesting to be in prison reading about, hearing about this, and it being used as propaganda. And so what I just found this really interesting. We were in this very interesting position where on a very large international level and a very like mundane level in our cell, we're realizing that these two governments and the cycle of violence and cycle of hostility they found themselves in is so deep and so that I didn't want to I just didn't want to be part of either way of propelling that cycle forward.
And it what also struck me about this and thinking about all of you being there clearly that governments by their nature can be authoritarian, and police can be where they are, and prisons the way they are, anybody who's a dissident. But you were able in some ways sometimes to throw Guantanamo back in their faces. They hated that when you did that.
Yeah, there was a time that after Sarah was released, there was this man who was put on our hall that was really damaged. I don't know what happened to him, but he, you know, when guards would come by and bring lunch around, open his cell, he would just scream, like, manically. He was so traumatized, and it was really sad to hear this guy. And one day he was screaming, and the guards came, and we kind of heard this sound of, like, chains. It may have been cuffs or something like that. We weren't sure. And then they're in a cell, we hear water running, and you hear this guy screaming. And Josh and I got up and just start pounding on the door. And one of the guards came running and stood at the door. He was angry. And he's like, you know, what's your problem? Shut up and that kind of thing. And we said, what is this, Guantanamo? And he was so insulted by that. You know, it's like, how could we ever compare Evin prison to Guantanamo Bay? That was kind of the worst in his mind. And they then stopped. They stopped doing whatever they were doing to this guy and went away.
Sarah, I was thinking throughout all the pieces you wrote and everybody else wrote as well, but there's this strange line between when you're in situations like this and after, between fragility and strength. And it's a line you had to teeter down and walk through this whole time, even since, I believe.
Well, it's something that the three of us talked about a lot. When one of the ways that one of the things you have to do internally inside prison in order to cope is to just become an unfeeling being. I mean, it's much easier if you don't feel what's happening to you, because how long can you just, you can't just cry and dwell in your pain forever. So you have to lock it all down in a box and become, you know, somewhat machine-like and numb. But that numbness, I mean, we used to ask each other, what is strength? You know, is strength becoming numb, or are you actually strong if you resist that and stay human and continue to feel, continue to love? Because when I came out of prison, that numbness terrified me. I didn't feel anything for a really long time. And I was scared that I wouldn't ever feel it again. And so, yeah, what does it mean to be strong?
Does that still come over you at times, those kind of feelings? Like
I think that I think that it wasn't, luckily that, you know, it wasn't killed in me, that ability to feel. So it came back. It took some time, but it came back. And you know, that's a coping mechanism, just to detach from what's happening to you. And the thing that I felt most grateful for is that it, you know, eventually wore off.
I think about the relationship all of you had in this prison, Shane, and the stuff you all wrote about. Just the things between you all when the two of you and Josh were put in a cell together, and Sarah was so stuck in solitary confinement, and that created some tensions that nobody expected.
It did, yeah. You know, I think there were ways that we were divided. You know, Josh and I were put together. Sarah was left alone. That was the first time that there was any kind of clear inequality in our situation. And, you know, I think I was always kind of trying to find who to blame for our situation. Sometimes it was myself. Sometimes it was Ahmadinejad. Sometimes it was a guard. Sometimes it was my own government. And sometimes, you know, the only bodies and people that were in front of me all the time were Sarah and Josh. And I think there were times that we, you know, Josh and I stuck in a cell together, in a sense, kind of became each other's captors. You know, it would feel that way sometimes, you know, where we have to organize everything together. We have to make every decision together. We have to create our own institution. And at the same time, Sarah, while she was there, was alone. And that just created a really heavy burden on all of us because she was really struggling. And we would meet in the courtyard every day and kind of large open air cell. And Josh and I would just watch her deteriorate. And there was a point where I felt like she might not be the same person when she got out. And Josh and I would go back to our cell and just kind of strategize what we're going to do the next day for that half hour, hour, 2 hours that we have with her, and to try to bring her up. And it was really stressful. You know, it was like we were all helpless in a sense. We were stuck in this situation. We were frustrated. And a lot of times the only people we could really communicate were each other.
And you know, I think it's important to add to that there were a million ways that we resisted our conditions, you know, that we resisted being institutionalized. I mean, what it took to keep our hearts open, to continue, for me, not to internalize the resentment that I felt and having to be alone when they could be together, when they could play chess and talk for endless hours. I knew it wasn't their fault. You can see how prison administrators try to divide people by, you know, playing favoritism. Shane and Josh could have resented me when I got out before they did. But we never let that happen. We never let them divide us. And we experienced similar things with the other prisoners. I learned how to resist by observing how the other women would stand up to the guards. Mm-hmm. They would pass me notes, which gave me courage to do the same thing. And our attitude changed after many months in prison, and we realized that resistance was what was going to really keep us from becoming a part of that place.
Pardon me, I'm sorry. And Josh, I mean, one of the things I also felt from this, your essays in this book was also the kind of what solitary did to you. I mean, and the changes it puts human being through, kind of twisting who you are, coming, trying to find who you are. I mean, people have no sense of that unless they've been through it.
Yeah, there's really a sense where, you know, we all are so many selves out here in the world. Where I'm a son, I'm a father, I'm a brother, I'm a friend, I'm a student, I'm a teacher. All sorts of different identities here, and in solitary confinement, that gets stripped away to bones and organs and skin, you know, an eating and breathing machine, and my resistance, if you will, is the ability to kind of reclaim as much as myself as possible. And I was dealing with this sort of difficulty of, you know, figuring out how to talk about my Judaism and my Israeli heritage. So that became something I held on to because it was just like something to hold on to. So I became more like religiously Jewish for, you know, a few months than I really am normally and was before. But it was, and I could see how you could become religious in prison because you need something to hold on to, and there's some piece of different pieces of your identity that you could see slipping away, and you want to cling to.
Right, and I think that piece of it as well. I mean, what they can accuse you all of, whether it's, you know, where you studied and how you got your money, the ability to where they got all of you to give up your passwords to your emails and then kind of find out things about you that they can then twist and turn to come back on you.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're of the mind that you want to prove that someone's a spy, everything is evidence, you know. You know, at first I was like, okay, I'm going to have this one interrogation, they're going to get it, and, you know, we're going to move on. And then the interrogations wore on, and I, you know, they kept asking me what I had been in Baghdad before, and they kept asking me what I was doing there, all these details. And I would tell them, look, go online, go to this website, you'll find these articles, you'll find, you know, articles about, you know, U.S. military corruption, Iraqi death squads that were, you know, trained by the U.S. military, and that none of that mattered. And they would just say, well, that's a CIA cover, you know.
Just to paint the picture a little bit more of solitary confinement.
Hold that thought for just one second. We have to take a very quick break, and we come back. Okay. We want you to pick right up. We have a great deal, more to talk about with Josh Vital, Sarah Shord, and Shane Bauer, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. We're going to go to a quick break here and come right back with science fiction Ornette Coleman. He was born in 1930. Happy 84th birthday, Ornette Coleman. We'll be right back with our three guests. Do not go away. And join us at 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. We are here with Sarah Shord, Shane Bauer, Josh Vital, three Americans arrested on the border between Iraq and Iran in 2009, they were accused of being spies. They were not. They put out a book, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. The three of them will be here in Baltimore Saturday night at Red Emma's at 7:30 p.m., 30 West North Avenue, right here. Go to redemmas.org. Just show up. Grab a cup of coffee, sit down, and listen and have this conversation. And join us now at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershore@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. I call you Schrodeman Short. Excuse me. I apologize.
Thank you.
But you were about to say something, Shane, when we went to break. Was that you?
And that was me. It's Josh.
Yeah, Josh. I'm sorry, Josh. Go ahead.
I just wanted to continue to just try because it's a difficult part, and we really spend a good deal of the book really trying to get at this. It's like how to describe solitary confinement. And for everyone, it's different. And it really depends on where your mind goes. And for me, when I would just think about the past in solitary confinement, it would just whittle down to just this series, this stories of regret that really led right up to the hike. And in the future, all I could feel was this impending fear about what would happen. And the present was totally unbearable. And that sort of bind, that like temporal bind of having nowhere to be, became so difficult, and it made me feel like my mind was my own torture and there was no way to escape that. And that's the 24-hour torture of solitary confinement for me. And I really think, you know, hearing other people's stories in solitary confinement, that something similar happens to most people in terms of the mind and the and being that most intimate torturer.
And I think that one of the, I guess, powerful shifts in your lives, and I'm going to come leap ahead to right now, because I do want to come back to several things I want to make sure we get to in terms of things that happened there and the solidarity you found with other people, what that meant. But, Sarah, it seems to me that part of what happened to the three of you, we can all speak to this, is the solidarity you found with prisoners in America, not just Guantanamo, but the tens of thousands of prisoners who are stuck in solitary confinement, people in jail for crimes they didn't commit, people in jail for crimes they shouldn't be in jail for, and this has become part of your struggle here in America now, Sarah.
Yes, solitary confinement is in a way a microcosm of our entire system. It's the harshest punishment that we dole out, apart from the death penalty, but what prison does is it tries to sever people's relationships to anything outside, to their families, to their pasts. And what people have to understand is that, you know, we have 80,000 people in solitary confinement. Many of them have committed violent infractions in prison. Many of them have also are put in for petty infractions, sometimes arbitrarily with no oversight from the outside. And most of these people will be released back into our streets, back into our communities. And if all of your relationships and have been severed, if you have been psychologically tortured so that you have less impulse control, you can understand why a lot of people come out and they're not able to turn their lives around. They go back to crime. Many end up back in prison, or they end up homeless or mentally ill.
And you're putting together a play around this, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's called Opening the Box. I work with Solitary Watch, and I've done more than 75 oral and written interviews, collected these stories of how people survive, why they survive, what happens to them in there. And it's just incredible how, for me, the learning process, feeling that what happened to me was in no way unusual. It happens to everyone that has to endure those conditions. And we have a lot of the same struggles on the outside. So the play, and it's also going to be published in an anthology that we'll do, which is the actual writing of people in solitary.
We look forward to that. We should make sure that comes to Baltimore as a reading, a dramatic reading.
Yeah, I would love that.
I talk about, I don't know who wants to pick up on this, but I'm also very curious about what you thought about our own country's response, the State Department's response to your imprisonment. Shane, is that you?
This is Shane. Yeah.
Ahead, Shane.
Yeah. This is something, you know, in prison that we were all frustrated with, you know, at different times, that we felt that we had kind of been left behind, you know, not by our families and our friends and supporters, but we were frustrated that more wasn't happening on the part of our government. And, you know, after 2 years, it's something that I am still frustrated about. I think that, you know, what I'm more frustrated about is kind of the way that our government exercises power in the region. And I think that, you know, there's no doubt that the Iranian government was ultimately responsible for what happened with us. But we have to understand that, you know, when we deal with countries with such an aggressive approach, that there's going to be repercussions. And we were repercussions in this situation. And, you know, there were times after Sarah got out that she was getting direct messages from President Ahmadinejad through an envoy, you know, telling her that if there were kind of some small diplomatic gestures made, that we would be released. One example was that he wanted President Obama to write a letter to Ahmadinejad, basically saying that he hoped for better relations in the future. And this was a non-starter. There was just no will on either side to kind of make, you know, to budge. And I think, you know, this is what happened to us is basically, it's, you know, it's an example of a much larger issue. We were kind of stuck in between this, and it affected us personally, but it really affects many, many more people than us. You know, we were just three people stuck in this kind of big battle.
Right, and it was interesting the kind of forces that I think that when you got out, came back to the States, the forces that you, that were combined forces of, I guess, the United States and Oman and Venezuela and more that had to come to play to free you all, and it was literally you were all being held hostage until money was put up, among other things.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, there's no excuse for what the Iranian government did to us, or especially what it does to its own people.
Exactly.
But, you know, luckily for us, there in international pressure, it reached a tipping point where the Iranian government realized that it was no longer to their benefit to hold us. That it was a diminishing return on their investment, and where diplomacy failed, international pressure eventually succeeded, and that includes governments like Venezuela, Oman, Iraq, and of course, public figures around the world and many, many individuals.
I have to say, I had the hope at the beginning. I had fantasies that the U.S. would somehow pull me out, you know, magically. And I remember some of our neighbors in prison would say, "Don't worry, you're American. Your government will get you out." But I also remember hearing, you know, when Ahmadinejad wanted to trade us. For Iranian prisoners, I thought, oh my gosh, we're going to be here forever. And I just had this feeling of like, I wasn't so caught up in how angry I was at the U.S. government at the time, because I almost didn't expect them to care so much. I mean, I know there were German prisoners, they got out after 3 months, and Belgians, same. And the foreign minister from Germany came and picked him up, but as an American, I just didn't really have faith that the U.S. government would actually care to do the same.
One of the things I think you talked earlier, we talked about the solidarity you found from other prisoners, and you all write about different people. But one of the people you write about, Sarah, that was so profound, was Zahra Bahrami, and the idea that you all really were in there with fellow Iranian revolutionaries and radicals who really were fighting to save their own country, and were executed, murdered, tortured, beaten. two things here. I'll come back to that second point, because I think that must have been a profound experience for the three of you in terms of your own view of the world and what it takes to struggle for freedom and dignity. And so we'll come right back to that. But, Sarah, I'd like you to talk a bit about Zara, because that was such a poignant piece that you wrote about between the two of you and what ultimately happened to her.
Yeah, well, when I got out and I researched Zahra, I found an interview that she did the day before she was arrested, and she was reportedly dragged by her hair from the streets into a black car and driven away. She interviewed on an international station, and she said, "They can beat us in the streets, but we're going to fight back. You know, we're not just going to lay down and take this abuse." And she advocated for self-defense. And that alone can be seen as a crime against God under Iranian law. So, but they didn't ultimately charge Zahra with her political crimes. They tried to cover that up. They said that they went to her apartment after she was arrested and found drugs.
Right.
And whether it's true or not, and I believe they were most likely planted, the message was the same. They executed Zahra. She's one of the most beautiful encounters I've ever had with a human being was what I experienced with her in prison, her bravery. And they executed her to make a point loud and clear that protesters protesting, you know, can be punished with death. She's the only female protester that was ever executed. But, you know, it was clearly a threat to everyone else during a time when other countries in the Middle East were rising up for the Arab Spring, and the Iranian government was terrified that the same thing would erupt again in the streets of their capitals.
You know, and I guess to come back to the point I was making earlier, just about what it meant and what you all learned, though, and as well as by being in a prison where people who are standing up and really fighting for their own revolution and what happens to them and what you all took from that. Shane?
I mean, I think that when we were in there, it was those prisoners were really inspiring to me. I remember a neighbor that I had when I was in solitary, and we would sneak conversations at night when the guards weren't around, and he hadn't been taken to the open air cell in a week. And they were taking me out every day, and I was shocked, you know, it's so terrible that they're not taking you outside. And he was so nonchalant about it. He was in solitary confinement too. And he said, you know, it doesn't matter for me. It's not important. For me, being here is a road to democracy. And for him, it was like him being there was part of this path where, you know, the government could be repressing protests, they could be putting people in prison, but it's all kind of leading towards a bursting point where, you know, there could be a shift. And, you know, I felt jealous at that time that he had something that, you know, he could kind of be sitting in his cell thinking, okay, this is heading towards an end. And I felt like my life was just kind of going down the drain. It had no reason to be there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there were so many really brave people around us that knew that many of them, you know, when they were doing what they were doing, knew that it could end with them there or worse, and they still did it. You know, that didn't stop them.
Now, there are aspects of this that I think that I just want a couple of things I want to get on the table just because it plays such a huge part in the book, and one has to do with Hava Kaori. I mean, it's in the book over and over again because it was your one place of eating air, as it is, right, in Farsi?
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. Because that has a huge play on your interactions with one another, your relationships, the love, the pain, the proposing marriage, the time alone, all of that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Josh, you want to start? Then we'll go right around the room.
Hava Kaori, as it was known, it was that was how we learned some early Farsi. And every day they'd say, "Hava Kaori, it's time to go to Hava Kaori," and then, you know, I learned that meant literally eating air, and that was our time in a courtyard. It was 30 foot by 30 foot by 20 foot, a larger cell, but we could see more of the sky, and just seeing more of the sky, that little bit more could make the world a difference, and it ultimately helped me feel myself more. And that was the place we saw, you know, after about 4 months. That's the place where Shane, Sarah, and I could all be together. And it was a place that we would do things to get us through. So, like, one of the things I was really into was having as many holidays and celebrations as possible. We celebrated half birthdays, celebrated Jewish holidays, Christian holidays that none of us normally celebrate. We celebrated Persian holidays. We just wanted things to look forward to. And we, you know, we read each other's palms on Palm Sunday. And of course, we didn't know when these holidays were, but we just made them up. And it was a place of bonding for us. And it was a place where we could cry together. It was a place where we were allowed a little bit of breathing room, half hour a day, sometimes an hour a day, to be able to open up and feel for a moment before being shut back into the cell.
I think of that space as when I think of the many memories I have from there, some of the most terrible moments and some of the best moments. I remember shortly after Josh and I got put together, going outside and meeting Sarah, one of the first times after Josh and I got put together, and she looked really, really bad. I walked out there and she just had this look in her eyes that was terrifying. And she started just beating at the walls. And I grabbed her and I pulled her kind of forcefully away. And I just held her really tight. And I said, "Sarah, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay." And she slowly calmed down and she said, "It's not okay. You know, it's not okay. Why am I so alone?" And it was this just terrible thing to experience and to see. And another time I remember the three of us meeting out there and walking outside and it was snowing and we're looking up at the snow and we have blankets and we just sat in a corner, all of us huddled together under a blanket and just sang songs for an hour. We just kind of all went through and remembered, take turns, you know, singing some song from the 90s or something like that. And you know, it would really escape out there from our imprisonment.
Yeah, the time in Havahori meant everything to us. And it was, I mean, it structured my entire time in solitary confinement, knowing that I would have that 30 minutes. I planned for it. It made the hours go by faster, and it brought me back from the edge of sanity so many times. And in my, you know, the last 3 years that I've been working against solitary confinement and investigating it and collecting stories in the U.S., I visited people in solitary in New York and up at Pelican Bay in California that for 27 years, one guy hasn't touched another human being. I mean, what we had is, you know, the only thing that brought any relief to the torture of isolation. And some people don't have even that.
And we didn't get a chance to talk. We have just a few minutes left here in this segment, but the big part of this book also was just the relationship with your mothers and seeing them. And that was such a powerful piece of it all, from slipping a note to all of it. It was just amazing, the strength. Well, clearly what it said to me was the strength the three of you come from.
Yeah.
Just familiar.
Yeah, I mean, I think of my mom as being kind of a starting point for me with just having an awareness about the world and about that there's justice and there's injustice and caring about that, you know. And so when we were imprisoned, I knew, you know, from the beginning that my mom would fight until the day I was released, you know. She has so much strength, and I saw that, you know, when she came.
Well, I just want to say that I think that what three of you have been through is horrendous, but I'm so happy. It's just weird here to say happy, but that it was the three of you in the sense that you three radical revolutionary spirits of light about where our world and country can go. You've been fighting for a struggle for a better America and world. Only somebody like the three of you could have written a piece that not just talks about what it means to be locked up in a prison in solitary confinement, but to come back and struggle for the rights of others at the same time, which is why, you know, this twisted world works in weird ways.
Thanks a lot. You know, it's the oldest art form and oldest written form in America is the captivity narrative, but it's always so often been used as a propagandistic tool. And so that was sort of a challenge, you know. It was part of our writing was to write a story that was true to us and not just the typical captivity story.
Well, I can actually see you now because Taryn Roeder tweeted a picture of you all at the ISDN studio in New York. So I would encourage everyone to come out Saturday night to Red Emma's at 7:30, 30 West North Avenue, to meet these three, Shane Bauer, Sarah Shord, Josh Fatale, talking about their work and their book, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. They'll be there. We'll all be there to visit with them. You can go to redemmas.org for more information. Get there early to get a good seat. Grab a cup of coffee and join in the conversation. And Shane, Sarah, and Josh, thank the three of you so much for the book you've written, for the work you're doing for all of us and for yourselves and your families and our nation and our world. And travel safe, and see you on Saturday.
Thank you.
Thanks, I look forward to it, Mark.
Take care.